But with all of these feasts, whether it's Passover, Purim, or just weekly Shabbat, it all started with, let's just try something really tiny. Let's order a pizza. I said this on the Abraham's Wallet podcast this week, but let's order a pizza and try not to do all the things on our to-do list on Saturday.
That's right.
That'll be Shabbat.
Call it Shabbat.
And, you know, the next day, we're like, let's maybe turn off the phones. Mm-hmm. And then a few months later, when we get through the pain of that into the life that it gives, we try to add one more thing. And, you know, I think it's easy, especially if you hang out with guys like you or Wolfenberg or some of the people who have taught me a lot about what this can look like in its glory. It's easy to look at that and go, no, that's way too much for me, and just not approach it.
Hey guys, welcome to the Dads Building Teams podcast, where we chat about exactly that, dads building their family teams. Every week, me and my friend and mentor, Jeremy Pryor, alternate interviewing another father friend of ours about his particular journey as a father, pursuing the call to build a multi-generational team on mission. As always, let us know what you thought of today's episode on social media at Family Teams. And without further ado, enjoy today's episode.
All right. Well, welcome to the Dads Building Teams podcast. I'm super pumped about this episode. I have with me my friend Mark Parrott. Mark and I met, I think officially about a year ago at a Sukkah Hop. We were with a bunch of families here in Cincinnati, hosting people coming around to our houses to just see how we do this crazy festival that the Bible calls Sukkot, the Festival of Tabernacles. And so Mark, with his friend Steve Emmanuel, came over and we got to introduce them to how we like to do that holiday. But ever since then, I've been super interested in Mark's journey. You guys might know Mark from Abraham's Wallet. He does a lot of discussing how do you build multi-generational teams and around the financial aspects. And so he's been really encouraging for me and a lot of other guys in terms of that. But welcome, Mark, to the podcast.
Yeah, thank you, Jeremy. It's fun to be here after listening to everything you guys are making with other dads. So appreciate the invite.
Yes, and thanks for coming down on this frigid Cincinnati day. So, and Mark's just about to head off to Man Camp, and he's going to be a part of this amazing ministry that really ministers to, I don't know, how many men typically go to one of these?
It's anywhere from 1 to 2,000.
Yeah, it's so crazy.
A lot of guys.
Camp out in the cold, and then they have one of the most incredible parts of the ministry is they do a MASH tent, which really is a prayer ministry, and they just see tons of deliverance and healing, and it's just incredible. So I can't wait to hear how that goes. But I want to hear, so what we're going to do is, first of all, I just want to talk through Mark's story and have you guys hear a little bit about where he's coming from, and then we're going to dive into just some insights that he's been teasing out through Abraham's Wallet. But yeah, Mark, walk us through a little bit about like your fatherhood journey as you think about like trying to understand what it means to be a dad, how you got excited about this topic. Where did that start for you?
Yeah, so I think just to give you an idea of where I was when my fatherhood journey started, I grew up in Texas and ended up going to school in New Jersey at Princeton, met my wife there. And after college, she was in medical school. I was in the investment banking scene and felt like I had really put my nose to the grindstone for 4 or 5 years. And at the end of medical school, my wife gets to this point where doctors basically can just say they rank their preferences of location for their next step in training. And she looked at me and said, well, where do you want to go? You've been working so hard and kind of funding our family for the last 4 years. So what next? And to be honest, I thought, what would be a place where I could just go play for the next 4 years? And I said, skiing sounds fun. So we ended up in Salt Lake City, Utah. And that was really a decision based on I'm going to recreate in the mountains for the next 4 years. So I quit my very cushy six-figure job and I took a job at a outdoor gear retailer answering the phones. Then I could, I made $8 an hour, but I could ski every single day until 2 o'clock.
Wow.
And show up to work. And so that felt fun. And I said, well, we don't have any responsibilities. It's no problem. I'm going to rock climb, ski and mountain bike and all the things I wanted to do. And about 2 weeks into that, my wife said, you know, we're going to have a baby. And it really, I was pretty, I think I was pretty selfish at the time. I, you know, I loved Jesus and I had the idea of following the Lord and building a family, but I didn't have any idea what that meant really, in terms of being a father. So life was really structured around let's give Mark a respite. And I felt like I really deserved a break and it should be a multi-year playtime for me. So it was kind of devastating news in some sense, to find out that this wave of responsibility was headed my way. And I thought, well, I'm going to have to change jobs. I'm going to have to go back and, you know, Goldman Sachs is the big finance shop in town. I thought, well, I'm going to have to call Goldman Sachs and tell them, here I come. And I really kind of hated what I was doing before. So that wasn't super exciting to me.
So it was kind of like a collision of the responsibility of it. Like that was the lens through which you kind of saw what that meant for you all of a sudden.
Yes.
Yeah.
And even for her, she was going to be having this baby at the exact time on our first day in Utah. We sat down with her program coordinator and they said, whatever you do, don't have a kid during this period of your training.
Oh man.
And so it was the collision of all the, this isn't what we thought we were going to be doing here. And I'm sure we'll get to it. The end of the story is this was the perfect time to start a family. And if anything, I look back and I go, well, we should have started years earlier. But the Lord really provided in that moment, A, just perspective and a willingness to step back and go, okay, playtime is over. It's not what I thought. This isn't going to be a 4-year vacation. And even with the work thing, I had been doing some financial consulting for the military, and I remember thinking, well, I need to make some money in this call center thing. $8 an hour is just not going to cut it if we're going to be having a baby. So I got moved over to the commission-based sales crew at this outdoor gear retailer, and they said, if you really kill it, you can make 5% of what you sell. And you know, sometimes you can sell a big group package that's $10,000 or $20,000 worth of equipment to something. And I thought, well, I've been working for the Army for the last year, and I know all the guys who do the purchasing. So I called up the guy who was in charge of the 10th Mountain Division. I said, why don't we just re-outfit your whole crew? And he said, great, let me figure out what we need. And it was a $17 million order, which just was the biggest thing they'd ever seen. And
that's awesome.
There's a long story around, I didn't see that commission check in anywhere close to its entirety because the company was kind of like, whoa, we can't do that.
We didn't calculate that.
Exactly. But I got into that job. I moved into a corporate finance role at that company in their corporate headquarters. And the guy who ran that shop ended up saying, hey, you should try technology out. And so career-wise, even the starting of a family took me in this direction of finding a job that I really loved, running tech companies for a long time, which ended up providing the margin to do what I'm doing now. But I would say the big light bulb that came on in all of that was that what I thought was just this responsibility and put your nose to the grindstone in a different way, sort of like what I was feeling about the whole work life before that. Like, oh, I'm providing for my wife, so I need to do a job I don't really like. That's not at all what came out of that time. So that shakeup that happened work-wise and family-wise ended up leading to joy and delight in a way that I didn't expect when I was in this self-centered, self-focused place where I was when it all started.
Yeah. So walk me through that transition, especially emotionally. Like, you know, like what insights caused you to have that level of, because I know a lot of guys who are listening, you know, sometimes when you get that news, it's difficult to not really resent the role of fatherhood, the responsibility that it's just shoving on you as this. And so it sounds like there was something happened in you where you accepted it and then you started seeing it as a blessing.
Yeah.
How did that happen?
I would say that it, I got to drink from the fire hose of the physical responsibilities of fatherhood first, because we had a baby and I had never changed a diaper. I don't know if I had ever held a baby when we had our baby, our first daughter, my daughter Kyla, who's 9 now. My wife had Kyla, and because of the season she was in, went back to work 4 weeks later on nights. And I'll never forget my first night with Kyla. I got food poisoning. And so I remember running next door at 11 p.m. with the baby, knocking on the neighbor's door, and just, I barely knew these neighbors, but I knew they had kids. And I said, can you hold this baby while I just go puke my brains out?
Oh.
And there was a lot of stuff like that that is just, I got so baptized by fire in the stuff that I had never done that by the end of the first 3 or 4 months, I said, actually, as painful as that was, I feel really capable now of handling stuff that a lot of dads might not ever get their arms around for years after they start having kids. So I felt capable at that point, maybe a little quicker than I would have if I had had my first child in a different season of life when my wife could really, you know, take care of a lot of the stuff that was going on.
Because she was working, she was going through this program.
She was going through residency, which meant 110-hour-a-week training.
So it just all kind of hits you. You had to be the primary caregiver.
Exactly. Okay. And, you know, we've had more children since, and it's a totally different ballgame when she's home for months and totally able to be the primary caregiver. So there was that piece of it that just took me from complete inexperience to feeling pretty comfortable that I was going to be able to handle the tactical day-to-day tasks of being a father to a little baby. And that was terrifying to me at the front. So that was a big transformation. Probably about the time my first daughter was 2 or 3, Steven, my buddy, emailed me this PDF document that I had never seen that was titled Re-Family. And that was what you had written, which now is Family Revision, the book. And that probably was one of the catalysts in me that changed it from the goal of this exercise we're doing here is to launch a couple kids out into successful American university life as people who have a commitment to Jesus and then wish them luck and go on retirement party.
Right.
You know, and that was really my vision prior to that. And I won't say that I read that document and suddenly thought, oh, now I'm on a multi-generational family on mission. I thought, well, there's more to this than what I've ever even considered before. And that probably planted some seeds in my brain that eventually would grow into the practices that we employ now. And I wouldn't say it was until my third daughter came along that I really even felt like, oh, we're doing this.
Yeah.
We're not just aware of the ideas, but we've actually employed some of them, and I feel like we are a team and have multi-generational vision for what we're doing here.
Very cool. Well, one of the things I like about the way that your story kind of went is that it really demonstrates, I don't know, the old phrase that comes to mind is God made the world well. And that is like, we have our own trajectory as guys, you know, like, you know, I certainly had the same, you know, idea like, oh man, I want to have fun. I want to have little responsibility. More responsibility just means, you know, like, you know, worse life. And, you know, you have sex with your wife, she gets pregnant, you have kids, you start to realize, I need to think about this more deeply. I got to make some changes. You start having more kids. You start to think about, like, and so it's just, God's got us on a trajectory that really helps pull us out of that thinking and brings us into his, the story he wants us to live into, and this role of being a dad and being a father. It just, it works. He's designed it well so that we fall into his trap, so to speak.
And I kind of mentioned it, but with my third child, so by that time, we're through that hellish residency period. Life feels very sustainable. My wife's job's going great. It's financially lucrative. I am suddenly, to my great surprise, working in the outdoor industry and making a killing, which I never thought was possible. And things are going really well. And because I'm a kind of a numbers guy, you probably pick it up, but I like math and I like money problems to solve. One of my hobbies had become playing poker. So I would travel around and play cards, and my brother-in-law, who's actually here with me to minister this weekend, we were on a trip in Las Vegas, and I don't know, Jeremy, if you knew that the Lord sometimes speaks to guys when they're sitting at poker tables.
Yeah, no, tell me about that.
Well, he usually says, get up and go home.
Yeah.
But that's not what he said to me.
Don't risk the rent money.
Exactly. Yeah. I was playing cards in Las Vegas, and it was about 1 a.m. And the Lord spoke to me very clearly. We had two beautiful kids, and he said, you're not done growing your family. And I thought, that's a weird thing to hear from the Lord. And of course, my wife is normally long since in bed, but I thought, I'm going to give it a try. And I text her, you up? Yep. What's going on? I said, I think the Lord just told me that we're going to have more children. She said, he told me that tonight too. And it was bizarre because we really, up to that point, still thought, well, two kids seems good. You know, that's a fair size. And so that's just another example to me of the unexpected way that really that point in time marks a spot where we started saying, like, we're excited for family to be the thing that we're about. It's not my job. It's not her job. The definition of success in life is really centered around the responsibilities and the mission that we have as a family. And saying yes to God, it was cool. He did exactly what he said he would do. It had taken us a while to get pregnant when we were having our second child. It took about not a while to get pregnant with a third child. That was just instantaneous. He said it and then it happened.
Wow.
And that was really a turning point in just our openness to what's next. I would never say at this point, oh, we're done, because I've experienced God saying,
no, telling you're not. You, no.
So I just say, we're open to whatever the Lord's going to bring family-wise, and we hope for more, so.
Hey guys, did you know we have another podcast called 5-Minute Fatherhood? In it, Jeremy and I take 5 minutes every day to bring you a quick tip or piece of wisdom that will help equip and encourage you on your journey as a father living in God's design as the coach of your family team. Find it or listen and subscribe by searching 5-Minute Fatherhood on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, or anywhere else podcasts are at.
Well, one of the ironic, I guess, parts of your story is that you're such a planner. You think about things. And yet in this area, which is probably the most disruptive area of life, which is having children and the responsibility that puts on you for the rest of your life, you've sort of had to hold with an open hand and experience God sort of directing that. How do you think about those two things, like wanting to really plan and be thoughtful about money and wanting to be really open-handed and let the Holy Spirit sort of lead when it comes to family and children?
Yeah, you're right. So during medical school, I had created this Excel model because I was an investment banker guy. And I shared it with all the other med students, and it was called the Life Model. And it had levers to pull for every variable I could imagine anyone ever experiencing. And I said, well, it's just like I would model out how to value a company. This is for you guys so that you can know exactly what's going on in your lives with all your money forever. And if you use this document, it'll answer all your questions. And that was my planning instinct that I think is God-given, and that's how he made me.
Yeah.
But it was my planning instinct running the show instead of being employed for his purposes. So you're right. I do have that desire to, when something changes, I want to run to the spreadsheets and figure out, well, what does this mean? And with kids, that's completely silly. Obviously, anyone who's had them for more than a couple hours knows the financial story is about one smidge of what's involved with raising a family. So for me, I think that the planning piece is, and we're just starting, I think, to scratch the surface of what this means, but it's a part of creating a well-ordered household that is a place of peace and a place of strength from which we can launch kind of offensives in the kingdom. But it's a tool, and you know, it can become a negative. The second we start looking to the spreadsheet when there's trouble, we're already not barking up the right tree, I would say, as a family. But compared to a lot of people that I talk to every day who would rather just ignore the financial responsibility, or they would rather not think about, well, what's going to happen if I don't have the hard conversation with my kid or follow through on the discipline plan at this point, you know, I'm sure it'll work out. That's a recipe for not having a well-ordered home, which doesn't create this position of strength from which a family can operate.
Yeah. Yeah. This tension of letting God sort of lead and decide how many kids we're going to have, when to, like, versus having a fixed plan from the moment you're, you know, even maybe before you're married, we're going to have this many kids, we're going to like do it in this order, we're going to have this much spacing. If I could pick the gender, I would. I think that those are very different trajectories, or they're kind of opposite poles. And I don't know, I just encourage guys to, in this area, be really careful about being super kind of heavy with the planning. Like, you want to, part of this is sort of saying that, believing that children are a blessing. And in some ways, you know, you could plan your money, but if you got $1 million, you wouldn't necessarily say, what? That wasn't in my plan. How dare you? You know, you would change the spreadsheets. You know, you would steward that, and you would consider how to do that. In the same way, if you really believe children are a blessing and God starts to give you more, or if you're actively preventing it and you're saying, we need to plan this out to the nth degree, the question that comes to mind is always, do you really believe that children are a blessing? And so is this something that, are you putting this in the wrong category? So I love this conversation, because there's a tension here. I know there are times where, you know, we have to step in and make hard decisions about family planning, but I think we've gone kind of way off the reservation in some ways. And I think that the way that, you know, it's fun having this conversation with you, because you really think through planning financially, you know, in a very systematic way that I think, is not being done well by a lot of dads. We need to do a much better job of that.
That's right. And, you know, I was listening to another podcast last week, and they were talking about this idea that children are arrows in the quiver. And a lot of times we think, as especially dads like me that are in my phase of fatherhood, that we think, well, it's hard to kind of figure out how these little pitter-patter feet in the house are arrows in my quiver. And that's really not what that verse is referring to. It's referring to the fact that as a father, your destiny is to stand at the city gates and contend with strong sons and daughters that back you up in that effort. And I think if we think of, oh, I'm supposed to think of these little children running around my house as arrows in my quiver, and really it seems like they're more of obligations to me right now, I think we miss the holistic picture, which we should be, that's the main thing we're planning with, is how are these assets to my family, like things that are worth investing in and worth cultivating, because these are going to be me in 100 years when I'm gone. They're going to be the ones standing at the gate as city fathers with their kids behind them.
That's right.
So I think it's easy to miss that, especially in this early stage of fatherhood, right, when my oldest child is 9.
That's right.
And so, but that's not always going to be the case.
Yeah, like I think the military nature of the family makes a lot of sense if you grow up in a village where your reputation and your family lives together generationally, and you're constantly, everybody's sort of like, sees your kids, sees them as adults, sees your grandchildren, sees this thing expanding before them, and you can kind of look across the, you know, 50 families in our village, and you can see the influence, the negative and positive, and even, but in our culture, this narrative of, you know, shoot your kids off when they're 18 and, you know, kind of hit the reset button, and we're no longer a team, we're not working together. It does make it difficult to understand how those arrows work. And that's where we have to kind of take a step back and say, you know, did God design us to actually live together even in those older years, and so that we can keep working together? And that starts to really make sense that, yes, this is such an incredible kingdom opportunity, raising children. And that, you know, little stage is just phase one of a multi-phase process that gets actually more intense and more fruitful as you go down. And so right at the moment where many dads are about to hit the phase where it's going to become most fruitful, they send all their kids off and hit the reset button. And you see that's financially. I mean, that there's a perfect parallel between that and finances, because if you only had, you know, an 18-year horizon for your investments, and had to hit reset button every 18 years, you know, go back to zero and start over, you wouldn't get very far. But if you had a 100-year trajectory, no, everyone would be wealthy, basically. You know,
like, that's right. I mean, I talk to clients, and we'll get to what I'm doing now, but I talk to my clients all the time about education planning, and people's minds get blown when they see that they might have a 13-year-old and a 4-year-old. And wow, if we put $10,000 into each of their education funds, we've covered 15% of the 13-year-old's expected cost, but like half of the 4-year-old.
Yes.
'Cause, and then when we think about that in 100-year chunks of time,
yeah,
financially, it's, yeah, like, yeah, the principle of compound interest comes to bear, not, yeah, just when we're talking about bank accounts.
That's right.
But and that's something you've taught, just like from reading everything, listening to everything you guys are producing. I got to credit you with a lot of our thinking on this when it comes to family stuff, because I've really learned a lot from what you've been producing.
Well, I mean, we've learned so much from families who have been thinking this way for generations, and it is.
You guys aren't the first.
No, oh. we're the lucky ones who also, you know, got to encounter just the way Abraham thought about this stuff. And I think that it's like it's almost like, what? Why is the church? Why have we lost connection with the model father and the way he thought and envisioned, and just seeing, for me, you guys know my story, seeing a whole culture that really honored Abraham as a model father and the way he saw things versus the way I grew up, which was that we didn't have a model father. And so we didn't know how to handle fatherhood in the church. We think about, obviously our heroes in the New Testament are primarily single men. And so it's confusing to figure out, what do we do when the kids start coming? How do we live as on fire followers of Jesus? And I think that Jesus would say, well, we covered that, Abraham.
Right.
Like, you know, and so you guys have started Abraham as well. I really want to hear, like, and one of the things I love to do is just dive into like a specific insight that you guys are having and that you've had around fatherhood. So I'd love to, one of the cool things, I love the way both you and Stephen write about this stuff. You guys are really gifted writers. I love how you're articulating the vision for what this means for followers of Jesus who are dads. And so, yeah.
So it's about 2.5 years ago, Stephen Manuel is a guy who's discipled me since I was 15. We ended up now having families with our oldest daughters are good buddies, and the kind of that relationship has just grown closer and closer over time. And we were talking about sort of Stephen's insights when it comes to discipling guys and coaching guys on vision and how to do that, and my nerdiness when it comes to money and planning, and said, what if we just decided to write a blog for our 8 to 10 buddies who we think might read it? And that's what we did. We said, this would be fun, just as a hobby. Mm-hmm. We could write this blog. And so we started a blog. It's called Abraham's Wallet. And I thought I would read an article that actually Stephen wrote about a year ago. And this, to me, really captures what we think of the purpose of family kind of being. And it's called Every Home and Outpost is the article. It's really, to me, this is like, makes me feel like this is what we're doing way out there in Utah, where we're kind of both physically and spiritually in an outpost situation. So yeah. I'll read you just a snippet from this article. It says, in the mid-1800s, the U.S. of A. started planting forts as they pushed west. These forts, also called frontier outposts, served as tiny exports of the comfy home culture of Virginia and Massachusetts, etc. These outposts felt like America, but they existed out on the frontier, in a place that wasn't yet actually America. Supplies were occasional and much needed. These forts were occupied by hardy people who believed in the promise of a future very different from their present reality. They were ready to defend that stake with their lives because it represented an idea they were committed to with everything in them. And they were surrounded by unforgiving and often hostile climates that were at best uneasy with their presence. And this is exactly what you're called to build, Bucko. Think about it. Your God-oriented home is, like Abraham himself, looking forward to a city not made by human hands, whose designer and builder is God. You're surrounded by people who don't see it that way, and your outposts will have to represent a culture that doesn't much exist yet in your town. You're an ambassador of the coming king, and your job is to produce a few people who understand this kingdom's foreign culture as their own, and then export it to as many people who are willing to receive it.
Hmm. That's awesome. Yeah, tell me what that stirs up for you when you read that.
So I think what it makes me think of, and the whole article goes on to really dig into what does this look like, but it makes me think of the fact that all the resources that we've got in our hands, whether those are children, or dollars, or relationships, relational capital that we have in our city, they're all tools that we have as we kind of construct a culture around us that's different from the hostile culture that we exist in. And that's really easy for me to feel because I live in a place that is the least reached place in the United States right now. If we talk about people who have ever even heard the gospel, it's about 2% in Utah. Wow. Of people who have heard the actual message of Jesus. So that's very easy for us to relate to out in Utah, that we're in kind of an outpost situation. But I don't think it's unique to missionaries or people in kind of unreached cultures. I think that, you know, there is a uniqueness to each family, and that is something that requires quite a bit of work to figure out what's our unique culture. Like, what is the thing that God made me like? And, you know, we talked about some of that for me. It's this weird planning instinct and numbers mind. And my wife, you know, she's talented in all sorts of other ways. What is the unique thing when you put us together that we might be, you know, out to do as a crew? And then you bring along a kid and we start to get to know that kid. And as we're training them, we start to figure out, well, this is the unique thing about this child. And then you add another one. Mm. And it starts to create a very, a culture that isn't going to look like your family's culture, Jeremy.
Right.
But it's something that has a specific role in the kingdom. Yeah. So that article stirs in me just excitement for, I don't have to export my culture to other families, but I can export the tools that we use.
Yeah.
And they can be super helpful in figuring out what's the purpose, vision, and goal set for a family, and then how do I, you know, take that and fund it, whether that's with money or with time or with people.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, and the fact that each of us have that expression of the kingdom that's unique to our family coming out of each of the outposts that we are stewarding and cultivating. You know, the picture that I always love too when I think about outposts is that, you know, somebody running for their life, like they're starving, they're harried by an enemy, they're lost, and they suddenly run across this outpost, and they come in, and then bam, they're in abundance and love and protection. And you know, that's the picture of the kingdom that I think households are supposed to be. But I think most Christian families, they don't, there's no door. Like they don't think of what they're cultivating in the home with their children, within their marriage. That's the place. That's the where all that life and love and joy and peace, that shalom in their house, that's what it's coming out of. And so this is the place where discipleship is real. This is the place where the gospel and people can taste and experience the kingdom, the incredible contrast. Like tonight, you know, we're doing our Sabbath dinner, and you know, my daughter Kyra, who goes to the elementary school, you know, just to make this really practical, you know, she's been asking one of her friends if she could come to our house for Shabbat, and she's been telling us stories about, you know, how this friend's struggling. It's like, so we're just super excited that, like, run into our outpost, like just be inside of, like rest from the enemy for a night, like experience the goodness of God, yeah. Taste it.
And this is why I think the apostles were told, when you get to a city and you're going to launch an offensive against the enemy, effectively, find the man of peace, yes. Right? Look for the household that is well ordered and stable and yes. Full of what exactly shalom. And I think that's just holistic. It's mm-hmm. not the family that's sitting there just doing Bible studies, but biting their nails and hoping that they have resources to provide for themselves that month. And yeah. It's also not the family that's fat and happy, but spiritually sideways mm-hmm. and can just, you know, fund the missionaries and call it good on spiritual front. So yes. Those two things together, that's really kind of my passion.
Yeah. I love that. Yeah. And I think the thing that, one of the things I love about just even the way that God is starting to bubble up these various efforts, like with family teams, trying to just train people and equip people for how to think about family differently. Abraham's Wallet and what you guys are doing through, you can talk about the Outpost Advisors too, like just you guys are working on how do we make sure that the walls of your outposts are strong? You know, how mm-hmm. do we make sure that this is well-ordered and that you're financially secure? And we want to see that grow over generations. We want to see that health and that peace so that when somebody comes in, you're not like, oh my gosh, how are we going to make it, you know, tomorrow? You're able to pour out abundantly on those who are coming in to the outpost and enjoying what, and it's not for your sake. Like you said, it's not just for you to sit back. It's for you to demonstrate that we have a good father and that in his kingdom, he wants more children to come and experience his abundance, his life, his love. And he wants that to be done in practical ways, a warm house, you know, a place of love, a place where there's good food, a place where, you know, you can be at peace and rest from the weariness of the world. And then from which we can go out and actually launch these offensives you're describing, which is really where I get excited. You know, like we want to advance the kingdom. We don't want to just experience it. But we need to first make sure that our outposts are secure and like, and they're capable of really, of directing an actual offensive against the enemy in a really right. positive way in our different communities. Cool. So let's also, I wanted to catch up on what you guys are learning as a family. Like one of the things I love to do mm-hmm. in these podcasts is just to sort of like, what are the big wins, you know, for the parent household, for your team. So describe your team a little bit. I know you've talked a little bit about your wife and, you know, your 9-year-old, but tell us where you're at right now in terms of your kids. And then I'd love to talk through, like, what are some of the big wins that you guys are experiencing sure. right now, tools you're using.
So I've been married to Amelia since 2005, and we have three children. Kyla is my oldest daughter. She's 9. Esther is my 6-year-old, and Sloane is going to be 3 in just less than a week.
Oh, so, awesome.
That's our team. That's who we are in terms of the people. And when I think about what we have been learning and really pushing into lately, I think about two things that sort of pop out. One is to learn how to harness this planning thing that really Amelia and I are both planners. And if we struggle with something, it's probably when somebody comes with a problem going, okay, hang on, let me think about it. Okay, here's the answer. Being solution-minded and fixers. And we've really been learning over time how to take that instinct and use it for good. And what that's looked like is we just got back 2 days ago from our annual goals and vision summit. So we take time every year to get away as a couple, and hopefully at some point as a family, but right now as a couple, and look back and also look forward. And that's been super helpful for about the past 5 years. We've been doing this practice, and it's gotten more and more involved over time. But I feel like we're still at this point. I mean, we really just started tapping on some stuff that feels like we're finally getting to bedrock on what is our vision and purpose for our family. And that was, just last week. So
when you say you've done this for 5 years and you're just now getting to bedrock, I think that's really common. I think a lot of people, when they do one of these, they think they're going to get the answer from Sinai about their family's mission and vision, going away. So like 5 years, so talk me through a little bit about like how that process has played out in terms of getting to bedrock about what that is.
Yeah, you're right. I see, because with clients, I ask them to go through these exercises too, and I get a lot of puzzled faces. We don't have this family vision statement worked out. It's like 3 paragraphs, and none of it feels exactly right. And I think that's where we started, as we said, well, by the time we started doing this, we had a good idea that we wanted something more than just kind of what we talked about earlier, that launch pad. But there was a lot of ideas about what's our unique flavor in the kingdom when it comes to family stuff. Should we, 2 years ago we came out or a year ago maybe and experienced Sukkot with you guys. Should we just steal some stuff and put that in our family vision from other families that look good and strong? Should we go look at the Manuel family and say our vision is to kind of look like them? So I think that what it's looked like is some of copycatting and saying, well, let's pull in practices and figure out which ones work for us. But then the unique thing that happened this year is it was really the first time that other families started giving us feedback on some of the things. So we didn't say it ourselves. We had other people say it to us, saying, when I was in your home experiencing God with you guys, this is the unique thing I got that I've never gotten anywhere else.
How did you get that feedback? Just ask, or
texts and
Oh, really? You shot them and said, "What was it? What do you experience when you came to our home?" Or
no, it was not requested.
Oh,
it was just pushed to us.
Okay.
Like, hey,
nice.
Even my wife, she threw something up on Instagram that was a picture of her sleeping with our youngest daughter, and said something about Shabbat Shalom, and somebody said a little comment that said, when you invited us over for Shabbat, our kids still talk about something that they've never experienced before or since that we got to experience at your table. And other people have kind of said, man, the way that you led in this time that we spent together, or the way that you guys invited us all into that party you threw, it was different.
Yeah.
And so that's not to toot our horn and say we got real good at doing spiritual stuff with people. It's to say that we found out that some of the things that we saw others doing, we just, they weren't us. And when we did them, it felt forced. But other stuff, was really easy for us to lead in and feel like this is us swimming in water. And so when we've got to the vision thing, it's like, this is what it is. This is the unique thing about us. So
hey guys, did you know that me and Jeremy created a special fatherhood masterclass we do online called The Skill of Fatherhood? If you want to immediately level up your father skills and learn an entire system with tips and tricks and philosophy and help that we believe can fundamentally change your family's life forever, then this masterclass is for you. There's an entire module on the skill of training your kids with about 8 teaching videos in that one. There's an entire module you get on the skill of coaching your family as a team on mission with 8 or more videos in that one, including multiple interviews with a bunch of families doing this and how they do that. And an entire module on the skill of building multi-generational legacy and vision for your family with about 7 or 8 videos on that. The masterclass also comes with a workbook that walks you through the process so you never feel overwhelmed but feel equipped and encouraged and ready to start leading your family in a bigger and better direction starting today. And we want to hook you guys up. So our podcast listeners, if that's you and you're listening, we want to give you an exclusive deal that we aren't doing anywhere else online. So if you want to get $20 off the masterclass right now today, then head to familyteams.com and use the code DADS. That's DADS at familyteams.com. Again, that's the code DADS to get $20 off at familyteams.com.
That's really good. I think a lot of times we need to listen to those messages from others, because it's really hard for us to know what other people are experiencing when they encounter our family. and so when they do, those are real gold nuggets to hear someone say, this is what I experience, and to take that seriously and to collect those and to bring those to that, you know, annual conversation and to get closer and closer to bedrock. Like, what is it? How does our family bear fruit? You know, what is it like to experience our family?
Right. And even being the budget money geeks, like, we look at our budget and we say, where did we spend money? And some of the stuff we spent money on in the past 4 years, we say, that didn't feel like it gave us any life. Even if we just look at our giving, we could say, that felt kind of like, fine, we did it. I hope it, you know, trust God with the fruit, but... This over here, this felt like such a delight to our whole family when we did it. And so I just think that.
So you evaluate your budget, you evaluate your giving. Yeah, well, tell me about other specific things that you found just helpful about what you guys do during these summits.
So I think the look back is always interesting. For us, being in Utah again, and trying to do church life, this year particularly was kind of a year that the Parrott family got put through a bit of a blender in a few ways. And so we didn't come into this summit thinking, oh, we're in just a position of strength. We felt strong from a lot of angles, but we also knew that this had been a really hard year, especially relationally. And so I think when we look over time and look and say, let's look at 2017 and 2018 summits. Oh, look, these relationships that we identified, some of them have indeed become the strong relationships that are sustaining us through this, and others, we were totally wrong. So looking back and saying, well, not just where did we put our money, but where did we put our friendship? Where did we put our discipleship efforts? You know, we're still looking for the Paul families in our life that are going to disciple us. And we've continued to pray for some of that. So we do a lot of looking back, and then we kind of say, of all the things we notice about what's happened in the past 12 months, what are we going to stop doing? What are we going to keep doing? And what are we going to start? And then we take it all the way from there into specific week schedules. So what are the big things we're going to put on the calendar? I know in the last 12 months, we as a family spent several weeks in India, and that was a huge thing for our family. And honestly, I wasn't super looking forward to it, and it was phenomenal and transformative for us in ways that I didn't expect.
Like, who all went to India?
All 5 of us.
Really?
Yep.
Oh my goodness. That's awesome. Was it a mission thing or?
No, Amelia had a close friend who was living there, and we thought, well, when else are we going to have the time?
Yeah.
And the Lord was in that. Like, I didn't expect it. I thought it was going to be a drag trying to get little kids around.
Flying that far.
But we got connected to people who were very close with our neighbors who had moved to Salt Lake from New Delhi. And they have become like super close friends of ours who have been encouragements through this whole time. And stuff like that, I'm like, well, clearly the Lord sent us to India to see the life you guys have lived for the past decade when you were living there, and now we share something. So stuff like that is just cool, and it's useful to stop and look back. But looking forward, I'd say we also identify kind of some goals. Some of those are financial, some of those are spirituals, and we get all the way, like I said, down to the when we create a set of goals for the year, let's put it on a weekly calendar and say, if we did all this stuff that we just identified, does it even fit in a week? And I can say that 100% of the time the answer is no on first blush.
Yeah.
And so we go, okay, Dad can't spend 4 hours a day in prayer, build a new company, and, you know, do all these fatherhood things that he wants to do and coach the basketball. It's silly.
Yeah.
So let's start X-ing some of the items on this list until it makes sense and feels sustainable for us. So we go through that exercise, and then when we take that home, we break it down with the kids right now, and that's fun, is sharing with them, hey, Mom and Dad heard from God this weekend. We weren't just off, you know, sitting on the beach. And we also then throughout the year, I would say, you know, there's the big vision stuff, the hill that we're looking at saying, let's take that hill. But there's the planning for the next couple steps that's been at least as important as the vision summit. So our Sunday night planning meeting, where we talk about not just the vision, but what are we going to do this week? What are what are the meals we're going to eat? That has been super important to us. And it's, again, it's spiritual, it's physical, it's financial. You know, it's everything. We had physical goals to fix some of our eating patterns. So let's plan out a weekly set of meals that hits those goals. And let's look at the grocery budget. Let's make sure that the time we're allocating to kids' activities fits with our broader goal that we created at the Vision Summit this year for not having kids' activities run our whole family week schedule. And that all plays into the weekly planning meeting.
And it's, one of the things that you're describing is when you set goals, it's really important, especially when you're leading a family, it's got to translate into the weekly rhythms and the different things you're doing that are repeating so that it actually gets done, and it's, and you can decide, to your point, if we can't do it. And I think that there's sort of a little bit of a different spirit around goals that can creep in, which is like set all these lofty goals and then just go for it. And people just go into massive imbalance, or they get really frustrated, discouraged when they realize it doesn't work. But what can work is a sustainable, like, what are we doing that's rhythmic? What's our annual rhythm look like? What's our 7 days? How do we plan this every week? And then checking back in on a weekly basis to make sure that this is really working for us. And you guys are leaning into that kind of a process as well, right? What's a weekly meeting or a rhythm look like for you guys? And how does that, you can tie that back as well to your summit.
Yeah, well, it's really simple. It's Sunday evenings. Amelia and I, we have a template that we print out once a week, and it's got basically the week schedule on it, and we create blocks for what has to happen, and it includes the big things like school. It includes things like Mark's going to go to, you know, men's meeting this morning, so my wife's not going to go exercise before work that day, stuff like that. It includes our meals. It includes the hours we're going to schedule for our household employee, all that stuff. And then we step back and go, does anything feel out of whack here on a weekly basis so that it doesn't get to kind of the next goals summit a year later and we go, yeah, that whole year I was really unhappy with this, the rhythm. And because I agree with you. I mean, we did the 7-day family course that you guys produced and found that incredibly helpful this year. And I want to refine that rhythm instead of refining individual just items on the calendar, because the rhythm's the thing we get to repeat over and over and over.
That's when real traction starts to happen.
Right.
And so you guys have a household assistant, somebody that serves the family.
Yeah, yeah. So she actually lives with us and watches our kids when we're doing different work things. So that's been extremely helpful and money very well spent compared to the days when we used to cart the kids around and get them cared for outside of the house.
Yes.
Especially as I've switched from working in the world where I'm required to be in an office to working out of my home and seeing clients either there or remotely. But, you know, I can just come downstairs and there's all my kids. So it's pretty great.
I'm curious too, Mark, I'd love to hear you speak a little bit about, you know, your wife has she's invested a lot in a career. Like, she has kind of a vocation that she's really invested in, that she feels called to. You guys, even when you went to your summit, it was for a conference that she was professionally pursuing. I'd love to hear you talk a little bit. I talk sometimes to guys who really sense their wives have like a pretty intense calling vocationally on their life and trying to work that out. And any insights for guys who are thinking that through, and what have you guys learned about how to figure that out?
Well, I have, I think, a really unique wife because she's brilliant. You know, she killed it in college at Princeton. She was phenomenally successful at Georgetown in medical school and kind of had the ability to pick what she wanted. And I think she could have definitely looked at the path laid out before and said, I'm going to go for the throat career-wise. I think my wife loves what she does. She's an obstetrician. And yet, a lot of times people assume that Amelia feels like her main calling in life is medicine. And that's how she will express her ministry. And I think Amelia is really unique in that she would say, my job is, I love my job. I love taking care of women. I love being a part of this amazing process. If I was to disappear tomorrow, somebody else would do a great job at what I'm doing there. The place I'm irreplaceable is in the family. And so her perspective is not one of somebody who's really career focused. Okay. I just, as a husband, that's just a massive blessing to me because I'm like, Amelia is constantly asking, okay, am I still, should I still be here in the job? Should I still be in the career? And for now, we're saying, well, we've found a pace that allows you to kind of be in the office full 3 days a week and maybe do surgery one morning a week. And that feels pretty sustainable for us. But she's had all sorts of opportunities to say, hey, you're a special one. Like, do you want to climb the ladder? How about administration? All these things. And for now, it has been really cool to me to see her go, no, my primary ministry, my primary calling is not being a doctor. That's a great vocation. It's a cool opportunity. But I have a unique wife who has the opportunity to do all that and says, you know, she's constantly like sharing this with other physicians. I would say is, you know, I encourage people, especially a lot of her friends who are also physicians who are mothers, like, that's the place where you can't be replaced.
Yeah.
There's no one who's going to be able to do that job for you as a wife, as a mother. So keep it in perspective. And I think it's a place a lot of people have a real struggle when their wife is highly capable.
Yes.
And maybe does desire to go out and get the positive feedback loop that exists, whether it's for a man or a woman in the working world.
Yeah, that's super helpful, man. I think that perspective that you're irreplaceable, that I think a lot of times you do need to steward some of those callings, but also, man, I love keeping in mind, okay, is Are you getting, like, is the feedback loop what's driving you? Because I think sometimes if the career pursuit is really about feeling this emptiness about, I don't know who I am, I need it, you know, people sort of culturally to be praising me and appreciating me, then you find this tension. And like you said, it happens more often with men than with women. But whenever that happens and that starts to build, where the home is literally what's holding that man or woman back, and they sense it, I get so much more accolades if I could just, you know, cut myself free from this shackle of a family. I mean, that's really what sometimes you're struggling with. And I think that it's really inspiring for me to hear, you know, Amelia be able to look at that and say, I'm not pursuing that. Like, that's not why I'm doing it. I care about what I'm stewarding, in this vocation, but I'm really dialed in and I don't need that feedback in order for me to feel like I'm doing what I should be doing for God.
Yeah. And it's exactly rooted in everything we've been talking about, which is that when the household is a place of peace and strength,
yeah,
and that as a father or a mother, but as a father, I'm like, man, I would feel like a giant loser if my career was going awesome and my home was not. Mm-hmm. And the only way to figure that out, I think, is to taste it. And the only way to taste it is to take one of these tiny little steps towards feeling what it's like to be at the helm of a well-ordered home.
Yeah, so that's right. So as you guys, I know one of the ways you described to me earlier that leadership in the home for you started to make more sense when you started thinking about it through the lens of like holidays, like holy days. Mm-hmm. Talk to me a little bit about, like, yeah, how did that help you in terms of this, what for so many guys is this ambiguous expectation, be a spiritual leader.
Right. I think that's a millstone around a lot of guys' necks, because they go, I guess I'll try to lead a Bible study with a four-year-old, and I'm going to end up slapping them or screaming at them because I get so frustrated when they won't sit still. And I totally resonate with that. Mm-hmm. I just felt like a dweeb trying to lead my young kids in any sort of spiritual practice. And I felt like, man, this is the worst part of their week because they have to sit still. They're not interested in what's happening. Mm-hmm. It kind of is like Sunday school on the best days.
Yeah.
And through Stephen and Dora, through you guys's, especially what you've written, and just a few other families, I got exposed to this idea of celebrating high holidays. I had done Passover growing up once or twice. That's something somebody had exposed me to. But I had never really thought about the fact that these holidays, whether it's Sukkot, which we just celebrated, or Passover, or some of the others, they're a chance for a father to actually lead their family in ways that are super engaging for kids.
Yeah.
I mean, before we started recording, I was telling you, Purim has become a big one for us.
Yeah, I'd love to hear about that.
And part of it is, we love the story of Esther. Yeah. It's a great opportunity for me to share with people who don't know God at all, like, a story that is really approachable, because the book of Esther is the story, they call it, like, God's face is hidden in the story because he's not mentioned by name in the whole story. Mm-hmm. But this is how God saved his people. And used the natural to accomplish the supernatural. So one of the traditions in Purim is that everybody dresses up in costumes. It's kind of like a Jewish Halloween. Mm-hmm. And my first experience of it, I think, was in college, of seeing the campus rabbi, like, running down the street in a chicken suit and going, what the heck is that?
Yeah, that's awesome.
And it's also a holiday in which a lot of Jews will drink enough wine that they can't tell the difference between Haman and Mordecai. That's kind of the admonition.
Yeah.
So we don't do quite that much wine, but it's a holiday that's just a big party, and you're supposed to read the story of Esther. So we'll get 50 kids at our house in costumes. We'll do special cookies and treats and explain how they relate to the story of Esther, and we'll do a kids' version reading of the whole book of Esther and tell the story.
Wow.
And it's something that's easy to invite a kid to, whether their family is Jesus following or not.
Yeah.
And they hear the gospel from us, and they taste it, and they put their costume on, and we go, why are we dressing in costumes? Well, because God was kind of hiding in this story, but he was working, and stuff like that. It's just like a slam dunk for a dad who's got a four-year-old that he wants to engage spiritually. And I don't think it's a fib when my little kids tell me now that the best part of their week is Shabbat dinner. I don't think they're just saying that to please dad. I think it's legitimately, we sing, we try out sometimes a new thing that we've never done. We had friends this summer visit and they led Shabbat and we collected like 10 new things to try. But with all of these feasts, whether it's Passover, Purim, or just weekly Shabbat, it all started with, let's just try something really tiny. Let's order a pizza. I said this on the Abraham's Wallet podcast this week, but let's order a pizza and try not to do all the things on our to-do list on Saturday.
That's right.
That'll be Shabbat.
Call it
and
Shabbat.
You know, the next day, we're like, let's maybe turn off the phones. And then a few months later, when we get through the pain of that into the life that it gives, we try to add one more thing. And, you know, I think it's easy, especially if you hang out with guys like you or Wolfenberg or some of the people who have taught me a lot about what this can look like in its glory. It's easy to look at that and go, no, that's way too much for me, and just not approach it. And that's why I say, the household thing, just you need a little taste of it. You don't need to drink from the fire hose. You just need to taste it and you'll go, that's delicious. I'll have another bite.
That's right. Yeah, it's very sequential. Like, take baby steps. You know, don't think, oh my gosh, I got to do all seven biblical holidays this year. Like, if one of them intrigues you, you want to try Purim, you want to try Sukkot, you want to try Passover, something like just, but I like the lens of spiritual leadership, wanting to see your children engaging in just real spiritual stuff in the home, through the home. And then sometimes a little seed that you plant, that little pizza thing, it grows into something incredible. And sometimes, don't ever look at something that's full grown and say, oh, I can't get there. No, the admonition is plant a seed. And that's what's so awesome about family. It goes on. You got years and years and years to cultivate this stuff. And we just don't, the Christian church, we just haven't seen what family can become. It's like, it can become so incredible. Me and April just flew back from South Carolina, and we heard some people speaking Hebrew behind us while we were there, and we turned around and introduced ourselves and said hi to them, and they were Israelis, secular Israelis, and within 5 minutes, literally, they were inviting us to Shabbat in their house in LA. We didn't tell them, anything about us.
Yeah.
Other than like, we're here to visit and we knew a little bit about Hebrew. And they were like, you got to come to Shabbat. You got to like, and they were talking about just how they've cultivated this over the years. Like, we're not religious, but we believe this is what our family needs to be. And we were so inspired because, to have something so clear that we can engage in the home through the generations. And so for so many people, it's like, just plant that little tiny seed. Like, what does that look like? What's a little baby step? So,
and we're still doing that now with holidays. That I'll get an itch to say, well, I don't know, maybe is Hanukkah something that's got some interesting life in it? My friend David Sheldon told me he's been trying out some Hanukkah stuff, and maybe we'll light some candles this year and see. And sometimes we've tried things and gone, well, that's probably not something we're going to put a lot of energy into every year. But cool, we tried. We tried it. And other times we go, we took a little step, and we might take another step in certain direction.
Yes.
So that's still the pathway into it for us. It's not just now that we've figured it out, we just go whole hog on everything.
Right. Yeah. I literally don't know anybody who's done that or succeeded at that. Like, everyone I know has done exactly the way you're describing it. Like, one little thing, let's try this. It's very sustainable. We can do this. And, but over time, years, and especially with the combination of trying things, the annual summit, the family meetings every week, you start to really steward this household, and things just start to compound in a very similar way that happens financially. That compound interest starts to accumulate over time as your family is growing, as you're learning lessons, as you're, you know, pruning things that aren't working, and you're cultivating things that are, and you're building something more and more beautiful that tastes more and more like the kingdom. The evangelistic impact of that, like what you described it about Purim, that there's a group in Israel that we're connected to that does every Jewish, Muslim, and Christian holiday as an evangelistic outreach. And so, and every one of them, they sort of just share the gospel, and they try to explore any connections they can find between what's being celebrated in the gospel. And it's the most effective outreach in Israel, because people get, they like, you get invited to somebody's house for something. You're like, oh my gosh, this is so cool. You get to experience something they've been cultivating for years. You see the connections, like, you know, how does this connect to Jesus? You hear somebody's testimony, and it's just like, evangelism doesn't have to be that hard, you know? And then even discipleship can holistically take place in and through the relationships being cultivated there. So it's just, we've made it really hard on ourselves by separating everything out and not figuring out that picture of what it could mean if you build an outpost and it's beautiful and it's got strong walls, but also a fire and, you know, a laden table inside, you know, ready for the children to come. And I think that's the vision that our Father has, and that's what He wants to share with us. So this has been an awesome conversation, Mark. I'd love for you to just share anything too about just what you guys are up to. How can people find what you guys are doing online? Yeah, tell us a little bit about that stuff.
Yeah, so Abraham's Wallet is kind of the place to see our thoughts. My writing partner, Steve Emanuel, and I, we post up on there. We have a podcast, which is a lot of the same stuff, but also some additional content with people we think are interesting, interviews and things like that. Yeah. And then out of that, there was quite a bit of demand for how do we serve somebody who wants to go deeper and more on a personally guided walk through both the vision and goals stuff, as well as then taking the output of these summits and these explorations on purpose and using them to power financial planning. Mm-hmm. So I, about 8 months ago, went and got all the licenses necessary and opened up a shop as a financial planner, and that's called Outpost Advisors. So people can see that at outpostadvisors.net, and, you know, the type of guy that reads our stuff on Abraham's Wallet tends to be absolutely delightful to work with on the financial planning front, because we just think the same way, and it's super fun to help families put order into all areas of their life. So they might be awesome in a few fronts, and we just get to come along and shore them up on places where we can be helpful.
Yeah, I rarely see anyone who can handle that conversation by themselves. It's so important to have help, somebody who's, you know, there's so many things you don't want to look at. There's so many opportunities you don't know about. And, you know, so I really encourage you guys, like reach out to Outpost Advisors if you're looking for a financial planner. Also, Abraham's Wallet's good stuff. There's a interview that Stephen does with, his dad that just sort of like, I still haven't gotten over it. It was like so impactful to hear the generational. I love what you guys are doing on the podcast and what you're exploring. And I think it's been super, super encouraging for I know all the Family Teams guys have been on there. So.
Yeah, that's great. And I appreciate the light you've shined over on our corner of the world, because even as a looking at the analytics, I can always tell when Jeremy Pryor has mentioned Abraham's Wallet, because we get a pop from your crew, and that's fun.
Oh, dude. Yeah, our pleasure. We're super pumped to be in this with you guys.
All right, guys, that's all we have for today's episode. Remember, you have what it takes as a father equipped by the Holy Spirit to lead your family as a multi-generational team on mission. And as always, remember to let us know what you thought about today's episode at Family Teams on Instagram, at Family Teams on Facebook. Search for us there, easy to find, and you will find us. And let us know what you thought, whether something that stood out, something that was encouraging, or some feedback you would like to give us. All right, have a great rest of the day.